We're talking with Oleg Kalugin. The book is Spy Master, My 32 Years in Intelligence and Espionage Against the West. But don't call him a spy. He was just the spy master. Other people were doing the work. And he'll talk about that. Which ones were the spies? The most famous U.S. cases were under Oleg Kalugin's watch next. And we'll talk about some of the people that he was involved with that ended up not living, and how he feels about that now, looking back on his years as a KGB agent, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oleg Kalugin, the Spy Master, that's the name of the new book. You can link up to this book through coasttocoastam.com. If you know somebody who would really enjoy this interview, but they can't listen, remember, it's a free Streamlink weekend. You can have them listen to the Streamlink broadcast of the show just by going to coasttocoastam.com. While you're there, too, you can click onto my blog, and there's some fun photos there, including one from Spinal Tap from a couple of weeks ago. And Oleg was just talking about the number of American journalists or activists that were being funded by the KGB, who, if they didn't know they were being funded by the KGB, certainly should have suspected that. Radio Moscow providing the money for a couple of different activities. Oleg, as you look back on it, and, you know, now here as a resident of the United States, do you think, you know, I guess I was raised in the 60s at a time when I was led to believe that there were a lot of communist plots out there, and that the communists were behind a lot of things that were happening that I was reading about in the news, protests against the Vietnam War, campus uprisings. Do you think that the American people, somebody like myself, do you think we overestimate the reach of the Soviet Union during the 1960s, or you really were as effective as some people say you were in stirring the American pot?
Well, it's an exaggeration. Definitely, it was American public opinion, the sentiments of the American people. They were against the war in Vietnam. They were against many other things, and they wanted some changes. The KGB would take advantage of these moods, and they would specifically single out some individuals and groups which they would probably finance. But to say that the anti-war movement in the United States was financed by the KGB would be entirely wrong. Now, absolutely.
And you were a fan of Martin Luther King.
Well, I was, but again, Martin Luther King was viewed by some individuals in the civil rights movement as Uncle Tom, the guy who is so eager to make a deal with the federal government that he will betray the interests of the civil rights movement. That's what we took advantage of the dissent inside the civil rights movement.
Oh, no, I know. But yeah. Personally, I thought I liked what you wrote about Martin Luther King, that you admired him, and you thought, in a way, it gave you a little bit more of an idea of what life was like in the West, although that it was bad for many African Americans, obviously, and that he was trying to do something right by it. There was something about the idea of this freedom. I mean, talk about maybe in general about how you started to really understand what freedom meant to you.
Well, Martin Luther King indeed was something of a special case, which allowed me, as a indoctrinated Soviet intelligence officer, to look at the United States in a somewhat different way. I mean, while we tried to take advantage of the civil rights movement, what we watched in development was something absolutely I mean, genuine. I mean, it was not a fake something. You know, in the former USSR, sometimes the so-called dissidents were creations of the KGB just to attract the Western intelligence services and bring them over to the Soviet side and then have them arrested and exposed. Not in the United States. That was all genuine. That's what really impressed me. But again, we tried to take advantage of that moment and infiltrate our own people inside that moment and then create our own moment, which would look separate, differently. But so it was part of our just business in this country.
That domestically in, say, Russia, the idea was to create a dissident movement to attract dissidents to it so that you could arrest them and jail them.
Well, that's correct. We were interested in make discredit the image of the United States as a power which boasts of its liberties, civil rights. It's all a fake, according to the Soviet version. And we had to convince the world, particularly the newly developing, I mean, newly just liberated from British and French colonial rule, the countries which emerged on the political scene in Asia, in Africa, some in Latin America, and we wanted to expose the United States and show that this is an imperialist nation and the USSR is a beacon of civilization of the future. That was the message, and I was a kind of a part of the propaganda machine, but I also had a special mission as an intelligence officer to bring people to my side, well, if necessary, by paying them money. I mean, that would follow later, but initially we would get together on simply ideological and sort of freedom.
I think that's I think that's a good transition here, that there was a time when it was ideological, and then it moves into a time when it becomes purely financial. So then maybe that's a good time to talk about the Walker family spy ring, because you kind of tripped into that, too, in a way. I mean, your first success was, some people would say, accidental, although you handled it perfectly. But here you've got one of the biggest cases in American history. And that one, too, just kind of, if you'll pardon the term, kind of walked in through the front door, didn't it?
Well, that's correct. But before I switch to John Walker's case, let me tell you, this is very important, that 1956 was a crucial year for the Soviet system and for the Soviet brand of socialism across the world. Why 1956? It was Nikita Khrushchev who, in his secret speech at the Party Congress, exposed the evil of and crimes committed by Stalin. And that really led to major disillusionment in the party ranks in the first place, because that was a secret speech for the party members only. Later, it was obtained by, I believe, Israeli intelligence and made public across the world. And that was a stunning blow to the image of the Soviet Union as a beacon of progress and social, I mean, justice. It was just obvious now that the Soviet system was a ruthless dictatorship. And that was part of my own disenchantment, the beginning of that disenchantment. In the meantime, I'm in New York, successful in terms of recruitment. I'm in Washington, and it's very important. But after the Khrushchev speech, we lost ideological spies, people who were driven not by money or some other, you know, sort of evil thoughts, but by ideology, no more. I mean, by the time I arrived to Washington in 1965, and from 65 to 70, we had only mercenaries. John Walker was one of them, the guy who just came to the Soviet embassy and offered classified documents and the key lists to American cryptographic system in the Navy, in that case. And we paid him money, and from that moment on, from 68 actually, and he would be operational for well, nearly 18 years. But he was one of the guys. We had others from, Air Force counterintelligence. We had some guys from the CIA. They were used briefly. They would be paid money. But John Walker is one of the most outstanding cases because it really provided us with the extraordinary information related to the United States classified information, particularly in this correspondence, diplomatic, military intelligence.
And how much did Walker want? I mean, it was fairly modest.
Oh, by those old criteria, it was he was paid $2,000-$3,000 a month. But that's roughly what one of the members of the United States Congress by name Dick Stein wanted in the late 30s, when every single Soviet agent was ideological driven, but the member of the United States Congress wanted $3,000 a month. And we said, no way.
And you said no to a U.S. congressman
right,
for $3,000 a month.
He's overcharged, you know.
He's overcharged.
That's,
on principle, on principle,
right.
You turned down a U.S. congressman who said, I will spy for you for $3,000 a month.
Exactly,
and you said,
but at
that's
that
too
time,
much.
$3,000 were equal to $30,000 today, perhaps.
Okay. Interesting. So the Walker case, so he literally walks in the front door. He's got these documents. He's got these devices. You'll be able to read for the next almost two decades U.S. Intelligence transmissions. You're able to decode all sorts of stuff before the country catches on. That's just, you know, and so that becomes another sort of feather in your cap. When you go back to the Soviet Union eventually, and you continue to work as an administrator there, I thought it's interesting that you went back to the KGB and you go back to Russia, but right away it seems different. You're not, for a lot of people it'd be like, I go back to the motherland as a conquering hero, but you didn't love going back.
Well, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, in 1970, when I was finally back in Russia, there was a very difficult year, which really played a tremendous role in my own life and in the lives of millions of people across the world. The Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of 1968. I'm a product of Khrushchev's reforms. I mean, 56, the time when Khrushchev denounced Stalin's, crimes, we thought it was all over. And when in 68, the Czechs went further than Khrushchev in their, domestic reforms, the Soviets could not just simply afford that, and they invaded Czechoslovakia. And I remember I was acting chief of station in Washington at the time, and I was, fully aware of all the correspondence from the Moscow headquarters, and of course I was in charge of all the correspondence sent to the headquarters. And I receive a cable from Moscow. Tomorrow the troops of the Warsaw Pact Treaty will enter Czechoslovakia to crush the CIA-sponsored rebellion. So please inform the ambassador about the event the next day and prepare the embassy for potential pickets and attacks by Americans and the vigilance and the rest. And that was an interesting moment when I came down to the ambassador's office, Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin, who served, 24 years in this country. And I show him the cable about the invasion tomorrow of Czechoslovakia. That was an interesting moment. He reads the cable, looks at me, and I look at him. There was an awkward silence for a few seconds. And then for the first time in my life, I blurted out, "Fools! I knew I risked my career and everything." And the ambassador's response was entire. He said, "Idiots." Can you imagine? The acting chief of station and the Soviet ambassador,
right,
both privately. They would we would never say that publicly. We both denounced the invasion as something which would cost us dearly in our reputation, and mean, and in fact, it did play a great role in the eventual collapse of the Soviet system.
That's so interesting, and you did stick your neck out there too, and so they but they continued to prosecute this war in Czechoslovakia. Obviously, sadly, very successfully, and you go back to the Soviet Union, kind of a changed guy. And so, when you went back then with the KGB, were you having thoughts then? Look, I think I want to get back to the West, or I want to get out of this, or I'm done with the KGB. I want to get back to America.
Well, I did not have these thoughts. Disappointments, really, which I experienced in my career in Washington, would be totally compensated by the reception I received in Moscow. I was the youngest officer to take over a major unit inside the Soviet intelligence. I was the youngest general in the history of the KGB intelligence. And the organization I headed, the Foreign Counterintelligence, was one of the most critical, I mean, in terms of the network it had abroad. Let me tell you, by the end of my stint as chief of Foreign Counterintelligence, we had nearly more than 500 foreign assets. Two-thirds of them were members of foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, and police organizations. Well, that was something, because when I took over as the chief of that organization, we had 180. By the time I finished, we had more than 500.
So
there was no reason to... and I was well appreciated, by my bosses, and particularly KGB chairman Andropov. I had access to him and the chief of intelligence practically at any time, you know. Just a direct telephone call, and you are received. And, of course, all the perks would follow up, and, all the improvements in standards of living, housing, which in Russia was a crucial part of living, you know, and many things which I felt appreciated. And there were no reasons to complain. And I would look back to my experience in the United States as an important part of my career on the upswing, you know. That's how I viewed my past in the United States, until my experience in the United States would remind me painfully of some other things which would eventually lead to my dissidence inside the organization.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that coming up, and then about a half hour from now, we'll take some caller questions. Did you ever have anything to do with the Robert Hansen case, the FBI agent, who also apparently purely for financial reasons spied for the Russians?
No, I did not. By the time Hansen became operational, I was out of the intelligence. I was in the domestic counterintelligence service.
Okay, domestic counterintelligence. But a fairly typical American spy for the Soviet Union. It was just all about the money.
That's correct. We had no ideological friends anymore. I'd say 56 was past the watershed. I mean, so ever since we had... practically none. All work for money.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned the Rosenbergs briefly in the book. And we know, that in the United States, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were put to death for their espionage. I think it's undisputed that Julius Rosenberg was a spy for the Soviets. Was Ethel Rosenberg, in 30 or 40 seconds, can you talk about Ethel?
Well, I believe she knew about her husband's involvement with the Soviet espionage, and that's why she was found guilty as well. And let me tell you, in the current Russia, man and woman, the Rosenbergs, were decorated with the highest award of the USSR, the Heroes of the Soviet Union. That's the only two Americans who were ever bestowed that great honor.
Before or after their execution?
Oh, after their execution, of course. Okay. They would never admit at that time. They were innocent victims of McCarthyism and all the rest, you know.
Right, right. Interesting. Thank you. So we're talking with Oleg Kalugin, the spy master. Gosh, he just does know everything about what was going on when it comes to espionage in the United States. I do want to ask him about JFK coming up. He has an interesting story about the assassination of President Kennedy. And then also then we'll get to why he dropped out. We'll talk about the people he knew who had been killed. And we'll talk about why he stopped working for the KGB and what life was like before he came back to the West next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. When things are marked top secret, that usually implies that you're getting access to material that are, you know, material that's been put aside, quarantined, considered too dangerous to be allowed out in public. But top secret did play an important part in the death of somebody, which we'll get to coming up in just a second, in the life of Oleg Kalugin, who's the author of Spy Master. I've just so much enjoyed this conversation. And we're just getting to the part where Oleg leaves the KGB after achieving the rank of general. More on that in just a minute. Also coming up tomorrow night, The Scalpel and the Soul. I'm hosting tomorrow night, and don't miss this encounter with surgery, the supernatural, and the healing power of hope with Dr. Alan Hamilton, who should know a little bit about this. He'll tell us more about the soul, where it's connected to the body, what he's learned about it next. That's Sunday night on Coast to Coast with Ian Punnett. But back to the spymaster himself before we get to your questions at the top of the hour with Oleg Kalugin next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oleg Kalugin, the author of Spymaster, our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. So, Oleg, I want to go back to 1963 and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Tell us about that time for you. You were in the United States at that time. You were, at this point, were you not, you were posing as a Soviet journalist, correct?
Right, right.
And you immediately had heard from back from the Soviet Union. They had a big interest, and you had a job to do, correct?
Well, right. The assassination of John F. Kennedy scared the Soviet leadership in the first place for one reason. There were fear, this guy, the assassin,
Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, sure. Oswald lived in Russia, had a Russian wife, and there was an obvious link between where he came from. And that what the Soviets were fearful of, that the United States would suspect that the Russians were involved. They stood behind the assassination. And I remember we received an almost hysterical cable from Moscow. Just meet immediately. I mean, that was an address to every single member of the KGB intelligence. And we had at that time more than 60 people in New York at the time. The numbers would grow later, but everyone should talk to all American friends and and acquaintances and tell them that we always were in favor of John Kennedy's course, that we had admiration for the guy, and we had no involvement. The Soviets were shocked. I mean, that was the message with which I would come around, and since I was assigned to the United Nations, I spent a lot of time just talking to literally hundreds of people, trying to persuade them the Soviets were not behind the assassination.
And were you not? Was the Soviet Union not at all involved in the assassination?
No, not at all. Of course not. Why should we? In fact, on the U.S. territory, not one single American was killed by the Soviets. In Europe, that's a different matter. But not in the United States. Not one single, even Russian defectors who were technically or supposed to be executed wherever they are found. I mean, as traitors, they were convicted arrested and was supposed to be executed, but none was executed on the territory of the United States.
So when you found a traitor, when there was somebody that you were, as an agent, you were supposed to return to the Soviet Union, or you were, all you had to do is get them off of American soil,
precisely.
and then. You know you were involved in the execution of these people. I mean, they would go on to some other place and they would be executed, correct?
Well, they were supposed to be executed according to the Russian law. All those who betrayed their country, particularly the military and KGB guys, were supposed to be sentenced to execution. And the man who, specifically... kidnapped, actually, who served in the United States as a former Soviet defector from the Soviet Navy, who fled with his mistress to Scandinavia and later came to the United States. He worked as a consultant to the United States Defense Department, and he was sentenced to death for his for treason. And we finally established through some, our sources, contact with him. And we also learned that he was a double agent. He had reported to the U.S. authorities about the Soviet approach. But we knew about that in advance, and for that reason, we wanted him to come to Europe. And he did come to Europe, to Austria, and was in Austria kidnapped and brought to Czechoslovakia, where he died on the way across the border. You know,
well, talk about that.
Him, you know.
Yeah, you were there for that, though. I mean,
I was on the Czech territory, right, expecting this guy to arrive, and what arrived was a dead man, actually. You know?
And so in the car, they gave him too much of the sedative that was supposed to calm him down so they could get him to Czechoslovakia to execute him.
Well, they would take him back to Russia, of course, to face... Well, in fact, there was a whole scenario prepared in this particular case. He would be kidnapped, taken to Moscow, while they would work with him, and at some point he would be shown on television saying to everyone in the world that he had been a double agent, that he had defected on, as a KGB guy, and he was always loyal to his country. That was a great scenario planned for this man, but unfortunately he died while being dragged across the border. He had a heart attack, and indeed there was an overdose when he resisted once to put into the car, you know, the overdosed this man, and his heart failed in the end.
This part I thought was interesting. His wife the real story of what happened was not reported, right? They concocted some story about how the CIA had killed him. Is that
Oh, yeah, sure. That was when reported to Brezhnev, the whole thing. And that was part of his guy's aides who said, why don't you say the CIA killed him? And that's what we used, saying that the CIA stood behind. He was a genuine Soviet loyal citizen who wanted to come home, and they killed him. That was the
story you all made up.
Yeah, concoction, true story.
And his wife, his poor wife, when did she finally find out that he had even been killed?
Well, he was not killed. I said it was accidental death, overdose. He was supposed to be on the Russian television in a week or two. His wife, she was in the United... I do not recall, actually. Was she in the United States at that time, or did she come to Austria as well? But anyway... for her it was a tragic, event, as it's all.
Well, I just thought it was interesting that she called you, and you finally had to be the one to tell her that he died.
Yes, that's correct. We had to. At some point, we had to. The more so that she was very active in trying to resolve the issue and find out what happened to her husband.
Right. And so talk about then, as you get toward the end of your career with the KGB,
You are a high-ranking KGB officer. You are the youngest general. You are so well decorated. Why would you stop working with the KGB?
Well, that was a slow process, and I personally pay tribute, so to speak, to the reforms launched by Gorbachev in the 1980s. But what happened before that, in 1979, when I was on the top of my career, and I would advance even further and further, something which was really a choice of anyone's life, when he's confronted with a choice, either or, and that's precisely what happened. The man who I recruited in 1959, when I was a student at Columbia, he would later defect to the USSR because he was approached by the FBI, but the FBI did not have sufficient evidence.
I want to be very clear about this, because this part's very key. So let me just amplify this a little bit. So back when you were a student, the guy that you helped turn to give information about, wasn't it about like solid rocket fuel
or
something?
Solid fuel for missiles. That's right.
Right. Yeah. And this is the guy who then later on the FBI gets wind of this, and eventually he jumps ship, as we would say.
Right. Exactly.
And he goes to the Soviet Union, you bump into him again.
Right. He came to Russia. I met him in Russia, and he was well employed. His wife, she was a Chinese, specializing in political science, and she would be also given a good job. So both of them settled in Russia happily. But something happened in 79. When the guy who came from America, once in Russia, and he was a sort of pro-communist in his views, so pro-Soviet, let's put it this way, once inside the USSR, he realized that his notion of the country was totally wrong, based on false information, on his own imagination. And instead of keeping his mouth shut, he would start talking to his co-workers, his friends, that this Soviet socialism is not what it they say it is. And and some of these contacts and colleagues of his reported to the KGB. This guy from the United States is probably a CIA guy who came to Russia as a defector, while in fact his mission is to sow the seeds of dissent among the Russian intellectuals and prepare grounds for potential overthrow of the Soviet regime. The KGB at that time jumped at this notion, idea, and started investigation. They did not find any proof of these allegations, but they spent years trying to collect evidence, and there was none. So they decided to terminate the case anyway. So they just placed an agent, KGB guy, who offered to exchange U.S. Dollars for rubles, which was an illegal, at that time, an offense, a legal offense.
Sure.
So during that transaction of exchanging rubles for dollars, they were both arrested. Well, that KGB guy was, of course, released, but this man was sentenced to 8 years in jail for the violation of currency regulations. And when I learned about that, I had a choice. Well, okay, after all, I had many other guys. Why should I care? Well, that's the choices we have to face in life, either to stand up and say, listen, this man is innocent. Why should he spend 8 years in jail? And that cast a shadow on my own, reputation.
Suddenly they're looking at you like, you spent a lot of time over there.
Exactly. Years later, a KGB chairman, Vladimir Kryuchkov, in his memoirs, wrote that I had been recruited by the CIA in 1959, and from that moment on, they would promote my career in the Soviet Union. I mean, ridiculous how it sounds, but that was used against me. And that was a reason for my transfer to the domestic service to investigate me more thoroughly.
And so you are at a crossroads. You are suddenly now you become, and it just goes to show you, eventually you kind of knew this anyway, that with all of the agents that they had, all of the KGB informants, all of the assets, it was mostly concentrated in Russia. Everybody was spying on each other. It was just a matter of time until it was going to be your turn too.
Well, that is true. But this is what... You know, these accusations would surface further, and I learned about from my colleagues. But what really averted me in a serious way, when I was transferred from the intelligence service to the domestic KGB, to my native city, Leningrad, St. Petersburg now, and I looked at, you know, my previous targets were foreigners, CIA, FBI, you name it,
right,
across the world. Now the targets were the people of Russia, unhappy, disenchanted, disillusioned. And my job was to ferret out those, you know, the worst guys and put them in jail or psychiatric institution. And that's something that I was not trained to do that. And my whole new experience really revolted me. I mean, I understood that the Soviet system was rotten and something had to be done to change it.
Well, everybody can read more about that in the book Spymaster, and it's very interesting what happens. I was just getting to that part of the book, actually, when we came to this interview. So I look forward to finishing that part of the story next week when I'm sitting somewhere on a beach chair looking up at the sun. So I'll break this off for now and get ready for questions coming up next hour. Your questions for Oleg Kalugin about his service in the CIA, the things that he saw, the things that he experienced, the things that he was a part of. But I made a dog-eared note here on one of these pages, and I wanted to ask you about it because I thought it was such an interesting experience. It says here that you worked for, or there was a time that there was something called Department V, right? Or Department 5. I don't know which one you prefer to call it. But every large KGB station throughout the world had one officer representing Department V. In Washington, we would have one who did everything from plotting ways to poison the Capitol's water system, to drawing up assassination plans for U.S. leaders. Now, so I saw this Department V thing, and it made me think, did they have a plan to assassinate John F. Kennedy?
Oh, no, that they would not go that far. They would have a more practical, in terms of special operations, to kill the president of the United States, that's an and it's a war against the United States. So no one in his sound mind in Russia would allow this to happen. In case the war was imminent and there were reports of the forthcoming confrontation between our
right.
two countries. Director or whatever, V as it's called, or five, they would have different, changed names once in a while.
Right. Okay.
They were supposed to contribute to the eventual defeat of the United States by, for instance, blowing up power stations, power lines, and poison water supplies, but not to kill people, but to make them sick. So you have no lights, no television, nothing, no telephone service, and you are, throwing up, and that's
right.
it. And you don't understand what's
so happening. that kind of poison, not kill poison.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
No.
Well,
no,
but it, you go on to say that this guy you knew who was part of this Department V, he disclosed the Department V's wartime plans in England, including plots to shadow leaders and assassinate them, and to flood the London Underground and to blow up military installations. You got to figure people are going to get killed doing that.
Well, that's inevitable, of course. That's
okay.
what the Director V existed for. A contingency planning would assume that you have to prepare grounds, for this, undeclared war before the real war really starts.
Right.
So that's what they did, but that was a special operation program.
It sounds a little bit like, and just a little bit like, the kind of agency that the mythical James Bond would have been fighting, those types of plans to blow stuff up and to kill massive amounts of people. This is what James Bond was fighting against.
That's right, but it never happened in real life, you know.
Yeah, but it was interesting to see how close it was, that there was actually in the KGB, this Department V, that even though they didn't do it, at least they had the plans and how they would have done it if they had gotten the orders to do it, correct?
Well, I guess all major intelligence services are supposed to have contingency planning.
Yeah.
For the time of war or imminent war, they have to be ready to offer something to the government, not just military force, but special operations to weaken and destroy some of the vital elements of the other countries or the potential enemy's economy or defenses or whatever.
Oleg Kalugin lived a pretty tough life after he left the KGB and then, before the publication of this book, Spymaster, lives in the U.S. now. My 32 years in intelligence and espionage against the West. Your questions, your comments, and I still got a few left over, too, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.